Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Music that you are listening to was composed by my guest that we're having today, John Emlyn. John Emlyn lives in the Pacific Northwest, and his story is rather a unique one. And we're going to be giving information on how, if you'd like to get a copy of his music, you'll be able to do so, but we'll be doing that later on in the interview. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
John, I've known you for a number of years, and you are a man that has been so engrossed in science. That was your professional environment, everything from bugs to physics. And you have this interesting story. First, give us a little bit of background, your professional expertise, what you've done for many years that occupied your attention before you decided to become a composer.
Well, I had two very strong influences in my life. My maternal grandfather, who was a physicist and a mathematical whiz, and my father, who was a biologist, ecologist, and behaviorist. And I guess the overwhelming influence from those two, I went first into math, physics, astronomy, and then switched in, while I was still in college, to biology. And I had the great good fortune to have done that because at the time I entered that market as a biologist, as a biology professor, almost nobody was doing mathematical modeling in biology. So I got in on the ground floor, and it helped tremendously.
Mm-hmm. So now, you were involved in that aspect for how many years?
Oh, gosh. From halfway through college up until I was 67 years old.
My goodness. My goodness. So here you are, occupied in this tremendously involved, intricate line of work. You turned composer, and your work is just wonderful. But
thank you.
How in the world? Now, I know. I've been in your home. You've got this magnificent piano that is just exquisite. It's just an absolutely awesome instrument. You play it beautifully. But what made you decide that you were going to go from the one extreme of science into music?
Well, you know, I guess it's the right-left brain thing. You get tired of doing one thing, you decide to try the other. No, I used to write music back when I was in high school, and then in college I sang in a double quartet and did some arrangement for that. So it wasn't entirely new, but how I got into it was kind of interesting because, I mean, it was after I retired, and my wife, who had absolutely no musical training whatsoever, decided she wanted to put some German poems by Goethe to music. And so she asked me if I would help her, and that sort of whetted my interest. And I went back and looked at some of my old music manuscripts and decided, hey, Gina, these aren't as bad as I thought they were. And then the second thing that really cemented it was that I had gone to a recital, a vocal recital, with some friends, and afterwards we went out for a couple of beers to relax, went from the sublime to the ridiculous, went from this nice classical concert to a bar. And one of my companions there, who is a violist, started ranting and raving about how everybody writes for violin, everybody writes for cello, nobody writes for viola. So I sort of patted her on the back, calmed her down, and said, relax, I'll write you a piece. And then I was stuck.
Uh-huh.
So I spent the next few weeks composing this thing, and it was torture because I was totally out of practice. And it was pretty bad. I went on, did the piano piece that opened the show here, and a viola and a piano cello piece, and then came back to the viola piece, and it ended up not being all that bad after all. So that's basically how I got into it again.
With this, now I know that some of my listeners have a real passion for music, and a lot of people, when they think of classical music, it's sort of like the way people think about opera. It's like, well, after 3 minutes, I'm going to be sound asleep, and I don't think I'll be able to hear most of it. But the reality is that classical music is the basis of all music. I'll never forget a very dear friend whose son complained about having to practice. He said, get your classical music down first, and then if you want rock and roll, that's fine. But you're going to get the basics. And there's so much to doing composition. You have to be able to write sometimes for various instruments, not just one. And that is something that you have done. And to start it later in life, for anybody who's listening, if you think you're over and you're still here, you're not over. You've got other things that you can do. And this is what John has done. He pulled out something out of himself from the past because of a wife's request of wanting to complete a project she had, and he's discovered something within himself that he really enjoys being involved with. Now, your first piece that we played right at the beginning, that was written for the cello, and you said
that's actually the piano piece.
Oh, excuse me, the piano sonata was the first one. Okay.
Right.
That one, you said that you really, it was like releasing energy when you did that
mm-hmm.
piece. And you said it was releasing your bottled-up frustrations as an aging composer. And I love those words. I thought, that's an interesting way of describing it. So you have this, and you're writing this. When someone is putting music together, do you hear these things in your head, or is it something that you play with the instrument until you get the tones you want? What is it like for someone who's composing? How would you try to express that to someone that would say, gee, I've always wanted to do that. How did you do it?
That's a hard one to answer because it really depends on the person. A good composer friend of mine here locally can sit down at the piano and, you know, he just can play and knows what he's playing, what chords are going to sound like what, how to put them together. And he does that, gets the idea from just kind of playing on the piano, and then writes it down. I work just the opposite way. I'll get some kind of a melody or an idea in my head, and then I can sit down and write the basics just sitting in a coffee house as long as there isn't too much noise, music playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got to go to the piano and sort of work it out in gory detail. So what I usually do is to get an idea down and then live with it for a while, because what really makes music successful is not the melody per se, it's what you do with it. And to make it interesting, you need different voices playing against each other and this kind of thing. And that takes a tremendous amount of, at least for me, a tremendous amount of concentration. And interestingly enough, it's where my mathematics comes in really usefully because so much of this interactive thing is very mathematical in its nature. And it's interesting that most mathematicians that I know have... are musical, and most musicians that I know have mathematical ability.
I was just going to say that they have found that music is one of the best ways to teach mathematics to children. That when you use that, it is a very nice complement, and kids relate to their numbers and to the beats and everything else. It's a harmonics. It's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with this, you brought up a point. The voices have to work with each other, and that's what is significant about what you've done as a composer. You have, with this first piece, it was the viola and the piano. They have various personalities to them, and to be able to bring them together as a team, what was different about composing for the piano, which I know you play very well, but the viola, you don't play the viola.
No. But you know, you grow up listening to music, and you hear what violas sound like and violins and so on, and you know their range, and you know what they sound like. I mean, there's a certain quality of tone, and it's really a matter at that point of, you know, let's say you introduce some sort of a melody with the piano, and you work through that, and then you'll bring in and have the viola doing more or less the same sort of thing. Writing music, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of repetition, quote, repetition, unquote. I mean, it's necessary to get people sort of sucked into it, so to speak, but you've got to vary it. It can't be a complete, perfect, replication of what you did before. You've got to vary it each time you bring it in. And eventually, you know, it's going to get old anyway, and then you shift to a second theme or do something quite different with your melody and then come back to it as a standard musical form.
We're going to play a second piece that John did. Now, this is a sonata for a cello and piano. John, what is a sonata for those that are not familiar with it?
A sonata is a fairly standard, fairly old musical form, and it usually takes, it's usually in three movements, although this can vary, and within each movement there's usually a main theme and a second theme. And what musicians do with this, they'll take a first theme, play it through, introduce a second theme as kind of a break, and then usually come back and do variations on that. And then the second movement would be the same thing, but, you know, a different. The first movements are first movements of piano sonatas, for example, are usually fairly, what do you use the word, bombastic, fairly dramatic, and then the second ones are usually very quiet, and the third ones are fast. That's not a hard and fast rule by any means, but it's sort of a standard form.
All right, we're going to take a couple of minutes here and listen to this sonata for cello and piano. This is Donna Seabaugh. I'm interviewing John Emlyn. We're going to listen, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. sonata for cello and piano.
No, John, actually, let me go. We got that some of these pieces mixed up. That was actually the viola piece, viola and piano.
Okay, that's the viola and the piano. Excuse me. I thought that they were in order, so that's what I was doing.
Yeah, they got mislabeled on the CD. So
okay, there we go.
The piano first, and then this, and then the cello is the last.
And the cello is the last. Okay,
yeah.
Then let's talk about this particular piece here. This had a lot of emotion to it. And when you're listening to it, it has a calming effect, but yet there seems to be an undertone here of a great deal of thought. It reminds me of a stream that you get into, or you look at it, and it looks like it's very soft on the top, and it's just moving along very smoothly with a few ripples, but yet when you step into it, you find the stream is a little bit deeper than what you expect, and there's a current flowing. What was the motivation behind this piece?
Now, that was the one that I mentioned before with my violist friend, who was bemoaning the fact that there was hardly any viola repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
And she was quite worked up about this, so I told her I would write her a piece, and that was basically what it was.
Now, for the viola and cello, they really have a nice harmonic together.
Mm-hmm.
What was the challenge in writing with the cello and then balancing the viola tones?
Well, the back step. I mean, the cello. There was no cello in this piece we just heard.
Okay, my apologies.
Okay, no problem. I mean, it was a viola, and it, granted, the way it starts off. I mean, the viola is much lower toned than the instrument. It has a very rich tone to it, so it's easy to mistake in that particular range to mistake a viola and a cello. And what characterizes the cello is that you can go way lower than that. You get a full octave. Range of a cello is an octave below that of a viola. But you can get those rich tones in the viola.
Now, when you were doing this, and of course you were inspired by your friend, when you finished this piece and you presented it to her, what was her response to this?
I think she was delighted. I invited her over, and she brought her viola, and we went through the first version, which was not terribly exciting, I'll have to admit. But she seemed very pleased anyway. And when we finally got the thing, you know, into a final form, I think she's been quite pleased. And she sat down with me since as you noted, I don't play the viola. She sat down with me and helped me, you know, basically notate the music the way a violist would expect it to be notated, you know, so they know how to bow the instrument and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it was fun. She's a regular visitor over here. Whenever we do something with violin or viola, she's over here to sort of try it out with me, so I can hear how it sounds in real life.
Well, and that's very good, because that enables you to work out any thing that is not what you want in the way of tone or flow. Her name is Heather Bentley, is that correct?
No. Heather Bentley was the one who played it on the recording.
Okay.
This is Michelle Nelson.
Okay, so Michelle didn't play this. She didn't do the recording.
She did not record it. No, she comes over to the house and plays with me.
Now, Dennis Van Parys, am I pronouncing his name right?
Yep.
He's the pianist that did the accompaniment with Heather,
yeah,
the two of them together.
Right.
And then for the cello and piano, that was Kevin Krentz, and Christopher Hahn was the pianist. Is there a reason why you use different pianists?
It was a matter of basically who was available and who was interested.
Okay, there we go. That's a good answer.
Yeah, when we did the cello piece, Kevin has a good friend. I mean, Chris Hahn is a piano faculty at the University of Montana, and they happen to be good friends. And so when Kevin agreed to do that, he said, "I want my pianist." And the original pianist he wanted, one that works with him in a trio that he formed, wasn't available, so he went to Chris as his second choice. And for the violist, it was a matter that Van Parys was available and willing to do it.
When you started this, you did it because you started getting involved with the music because of your wife, and now you have produced your first CD. you're going out and you're mingling with people, you're doing appearances, there are performances that have been done with this. In fact, we heard a live performance at a local facility in our area. John, when you did this, did you ever imagine that you would want to continue with this? I mean, this isn't just a one-time thing. You've got some other plans in the agenda. How are you feeling about this, and what are you looking at accomplishing next?
Well, that's hard to say, and it's difficult to evaluate yourself, too. And there are a tremendous number of composers out there. I mean, I've been phenomenally lucky to have the connections I have. I'd venture to say most people who want to make a living composing never get their things performed. It costs money to get to hire these musicians, and unless you have a little bit of money to start with and some contacts and some people willing to sort of help you out, it just doesn't happen. So, once I got that, I got pretty excited about it. And so right now I'm working on in as much as there's very little repertoire for viola and there's a demand by viola teachers, right now I'm finishing up a book of 8 to 10 intermediate level viola pieces, viola piano parts. And hopefully I can talk a bunch of viola teachers into buying them, and that will, help a little bit, and we can go on from there and just see what happens.
Now, you bring up a very interesting point that I feel many times when people look at persons in the entertainment business, they will look at those people that are the most public. Someone meeting you saying, oh, my goodness, you're a composer, and they have this particular image that that's what you do. But there is so much behind the creating of music and what you do with that music. And very few people, unless they're involved with it, realize that books need to be written, like you're doing for the teaching of the viola. And there have to be those individuals that are going to be able to commit to doing something like this so that music will be continued in the area of education and its particular niche, whatever that might be. And every instrument needs someone like that. And here you are discovering that the viola is something that you're able to write for. Mm-hmm. And people that say, gee whiz, we haven't had this. This is really, really wonderful. There is a way of making a living. If someone wanted to do that, they can do that. But it is work. It is effort. And at this time in your life, you really have started a whole new career.
That's true.
And it's fascinating to see it. And I really like your point about the support that you have had. Mm-hmm. And for you to reach the point of producing the CD, there had to be studio work. There had to be the coordinating of time and location of being able to pull it all together. There had to be the rehearsals, all of these things that go on, so that something can be put on a little disc that someone can put into a machine and listen to and go, oh, isn't that nice? They haven't a clue as to what goes behind it.
That's probably true.
And what would your advice be to someone that wanted to do something like this?
Oh, boy. I think the same advice was given to me by another violist who has since performed this piece. If you're concentrating on a particular instrument, get to know the people who do that, particularly the teachers. Get on the internet, go through all the universities and colleges in your area and find out who these people are. Ideally, find somebody who actually knows them personally, because a lot of these musicians will get stuff sent to them constantly to the point where they don't even open their email.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helps to have those contacts. And if you have somebody, befriend musicians, in other words, befriend successful musicians and go out from there. The other thing that this, one thing I would dearly love is to write for orchestra. But, it's difficult enough to get a good pianist and a good pianist together with a good string player, much less a full orchestra. So unless you've got something that's sheer genius and you happen to just be phenomenally lucky, it ain't going to get played.
It's a whole different world that, unless you've had any exposure to it, you don't realize how challenging it really is. But the truth is, the circle of professional musicians is really quite a small one.
Yeah, actually it is. I mean, yes and no. I mean, once you start getting to know the, you know, you get to know others and you realize there are an awful lot of people, even in, I mean, you know, in the Seattle area here, there are a lot of people. And, you know, I'm just beginning to get to know them.
Well, I think it's exciting. Now, John, what is the website? We're going to be closing out with playing the last piece
okay.
on your CD.
Yeah, the website is johnemlin.com, and I should say that we had one little problem. We have run out of CDs, and we're going to make another printing. So if any of your audience out there wants to order them, it's probably going to be another 3 or 4 weeks before they are available again. But go on johnemlin.com, and there's a... some things on music there. There's a blog, a history, and enjoy.
Well, I think that's marvelous. Now, for those of you listening, if you think you're too old to start into a new direction, John started his direction after the age of 67. So you know, you can be sort of like the Energizer Bunny and keep going, going, and going, but playing to your own tune, maybe not a drum, maybe a viola, maybe something else. But it's important to realize that if you have creativity and you are able to touch it, you're going to be able to shift your life just like John did and encounter a whole world of opportunity, people, situations, and beauty that you otherwise perhaps would never, ever have even known existed. John, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today, and I know we're going to be playing your music. Your website is johnemlin.com. They're sold out of the CDs. So if you wanted to just make a note of that, check out his website. And then the new ones will be coming out. They will be available. Well, John, I'd say that all of your influence, your science background, and everything else now is flowing in an entirely different direction. And I'm glad to know you and so pleased and proud that you were able to be a part of the show today. Thank you so very much. And we're going to close out with the piano piece.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in Physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello, this is Donna. Welcome back, and I hope you enjoyed John Emlyn's music. It is something that when you have an opportunity to meet and get to know somebody who has decided to go into an arena that's brand new and they end up doing such an outstanding job with their music, it is really very, very special. At least in my book it is. So I'm so pleased he was able to join us today. Now, by the way, telephone lines are open. 888-815-9756 is the telephone number that you can call into. 888-815-9756. For those of you that are new listeners, all you need to do is give me your first name or initial, and then I'm happy to tell you about yourself, things that are going on in your life, and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And then you're welcome, of course, to ask me a question about anything that is important to you. So 888-815-9756. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Queen Dee's recipe book, Cindy McGonigal. This is a lady who is so much fun. We're going to be talking about fairies, recipes that I think are going to surprise you. Yes, these are recipes for a number of interesting items. Cindy is out of Oregon, and she is very much a storyteller about fairies and special recipes. So we're going to have a good time tomorrow, so I invite you to join me. Oh, by the way, let me tell you about who's coming up. Useful Information for Everyday Living, Michelle Stefanikos is going to be with us. Everything She Wished She Knew When She Was Younger. So this is a fun book. Lithomancy. Have you ever heard of that term, lithomancy? Well, it is the art of reading stones, and we are going to be talking with a specialist in that area. Then on Friday, we'll be talking about the Delta Solution with Patrick Robinson. So we've got an interesting lineup, a great lineup for the full month that is coming up. But by the way, I want you to know that that list regarding my guests and a short bio on each person, not bio, but a write-up about each one, is right there under show information. So you can go in at any time and check that out. I wanted to share a fun story with you today. I guess using the word fun would be maybe inappropriate. Let's just say an interesting story, because the person that had the experience, I don't think, thought it was a lot of fun. This is about a man by the name of James Byrne Worson. Now, this is a situation that took place in the 1800s. It was 1873, in fact, and it was documented. This is a man who was a shoemaker. That's right, a shoemaker. And he was from Lymington, Warwickshire, England. And he ran himself off the visible face of the earth. Intriguing? Yes, you bet. Now, he was a long-distance runner, loved doing it, really had a passion for it. And he would run any time and every time he possibly could because he was so good as a runner. He was setting all kinds of records. And there in England, he would run from town to town, and people would get excited, and they'd time him. Well, there was this event that occurred on this particular day. He had three friends who were with him. One was Hammerson Burns, who was a photographer, taking pictures of him during each of his races. And there was another, Barnum Wise. He was a linen draper, and another person there. And there was a challenge put before James. Now, they bet that he couldn't do a run, doing a round trip from their hometown of Leamington to Coventry and back, which was about 40 miles. Just thinking about that makes me tired, but not James. He was ready to really prove that he could do it. So he set off down the road. His buddies were keeping him company, just like they do today. They were either beside him or a few yards behind him, but they weren't running. They were in a horse-drawn cart. And in no time, he was out of sight. This guy was really a runner. He set a pace of a very steady jog, just very consistent. He wasn't trying to sprint. He just was really moving in the rhythm with his body. And he was chatting to his buddies as he goes along. You know, they got their little horse and buggy, and they're right there with him necessarily, right by side by side. Now, all of a sudden, he fell forward as if he was stumbling. He cried out, and he disappeared right in front of their eyes. That's right. Three witnesses to this, he disappeared in front of their eyes. His body never touched the ground. All they know is that they saw him. He was running. He cried out. Looked like he stumbled. Poof, he's gone. The three friends searched and searched, but didn't find him anywhere. Well, they were terrified. They didn't know what had happened. They went back to a police station in Leamington. Now, you can imagine, in the 1800s, three men walking in, scared to death, talking probably all at the same time, trying to communicate what had happened. They thought they were all drunk. They weren't. They realized these guys were terrified. They had seen something they couldn't explain, and they just didn't know what to do. Well, they were questioned for a long time, and the authorities realized these guys, again, were not joking. Do you know what? They never found him. He disappeared in front of their eyes, but nothing was ever found of James Byrne Worson. Made up? No. A documented story. He probably, somehow or another, entered into a time warp. And why it happens or when it happens, not always explainable. We just don't know. There's a lot of things that have happened to ships throughout the centuries and other things as well. And we just don't have the answers. We don't know. Maybe one day we'll find out. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756 is a telephone number to call into if you would like to have me give you some intuitive insight. I'd be glad to do that. In today's world, there so often is the conversation about lack. We will talk about what we don't have. We will talk about so much of what doesn't work right. However, if you study history, you'll find that those circumstances have existed before. So what does it take? What does it take to really be in a position to acquire what you need for a good lifestyle? What are some of the tools that you can use? Well, Benjamin Franklin, I think, is a very profound character in history. This is a man who worked as an indentured servant here in the United States. And that's a slave positioning. But he was able, after a certain period of time, then to be able to stand on his own two feet and start businesses of his own. And he had done very, very well and ended up being a representative for the United States in Europe. And there's a lot of stories about Mr. Ben Franklin. And he was a fascinating man. He was an inventor. But there is a gentleman that I had on my show, Ron Willingham, and this was a while back, and Ron had put together the 10 laws of wealth and abundance. And I thought I would share them with you because this book that he wrote about Ben Franklin is something that you want to pick up every once in a while to remind you that hard times have been around in one form or another. And depending on where you are or who you are at any point in your life, you can either be on the low scale financially or you can be on the upper end. What you do with the environment that you're within makes all the difference in the world. So I thought I'd share the 10 laws of wealth and abundance with you. It's one, choose to be the master of your own destiny. That's extremely important. You make your choices. Life sometimes will put you into positionings where you may not feel like you have a choice, but you never forget that your mind belongs to you. And if you're willing to learn and grow, you can be the master of your own destiny. Law number two, fix your mind on specific objectives. And that is, don't be willy-nilly about life. Really look at what's important. Really take the time to sit down and assess what it is that means the most to you. Success is determined not by the dollar sign, but what you as an individual perceive as success. And that varies with everyone. And there isn't one thing that's better than the other. But living your life with a sense of purpose and quality is very important. So be specific. Trim your expenses to weigh less than your income. That's not anything new. But good old Benjamin Franklin understood that very, very well. And it serves good purpose when we keep that in mind. And even when people have gone through difficult times, I've interviewed so many through the years that they've said that one of the lessons that they have learned is that they had to work with money differently. Again, hard times can happen to any of us, but you don't have to stay in them or stay stuck with them. Lesson number four, set aside for yourself a part of everything you earn. Put that aside for yourself, whether it's a dime, whether it's $1,000 a month. It doesn't make any difference, but set it aside and be consistent with it. There was a dear lady I remember reading about. This was a woman in the South. She was a black woman that didn't make a lot of money. She worked as a maid, but she had developed this patterning of saving. Every time she got some money, 10% automatically went into her bank account. Just did that automatically. Didn't even worry about checking her balance or anything else. She just put it in there regularly. Well, when the time came for her to retire, and she was 68, 70 years of age, one of the bankers that she had banked with for a long time that knew her quite well and called her by name one day and said, "Are you aware that you have well over $100,000? In your savings account?" She said, "I have how much?" She didn't even know how much she had. And he said, "Yes, what would you like to do with it?" And she said, "Oh my goodness, I had no idea I had saved that much money." She then proceeded to make a choice about how she wanted to use that money, and of course that's a story in and of itself. But that is how much she had accumulated from just putting aside a certain amount. And then number five, increase your income by multiplying your value to others. Have multiple sources of income. That is a very good thing to develop. Number six, invest with the greatest prudence and safety. And that takes time, it takes effort, and it takes thinking things out. And then number seven, borrow only what you have the ability to repay. That is something that often we don't recognize that we need to do. That's where credit cards can get us into trouble. Establish good habits is lesson number eight, or law number eight, I should say. Establish good habits, and they will establish you. Remember, it takes about 21 days to create a new habit, double that amount. But in 3 months, if you're consistent about what you're doing and changing a habit, it usually will stick. And law number nine, choose to associate with wise, successful people. The company you keep does make a difference. The material you read does make a difference. And the last law is increase your wealth by sharing it. Those are the 10 Laws of Abundance, Benjamin Franklin's special. Worked for him. I think it can work for us. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Enter the magical world of God's Kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe. even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. I wanted to share something with you today about stones. I had someone call me earlier today and say, Donna, do you have anything you can recommend regarding information on stones? Well, I just am enthralled by them, but that is not my major focus in my life. And I told her about a book, and I recommend it to you. It's called The Book of Stones. It's by Robert Simons and Nisha Ossian. And this book is so incredibly magnificent, and it's been a part of my library. I've tried to get them on as guests, and it just hasn't worked out. But I wanted to share with you some information about a stone that I have had the opportunity to see more than once at different trade shows and events that I've been at, but I didn't know too much about it. And it's called the Black Phantom Quartz. Have you ever heard of it? Well, it's absolutely gorgeous. It has this phenomenal shadow effect in this crystalline quartz structure, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Now, it is a silicon dioxide mineral, and the reason they call it a black phantom quartz is that there are like phantom inclusions of carbon or manganese, and it just brings a very special effect with it. Now, they're found in Arkansas, right here in the U.S. They're just absolutely beautiful. Now, Robert and Nisha each present in their publication a perception about the stones and the value. And Robert says that this quartz is a very useful tool for seeing and integrating one's personal shadow. And he describes the shadow self as containing all that's been denied or labeled unacceptable by one's family, community, culture, and also by our own personal judgments. And he said, usually we're not conscious of our shadows, and it can sometimes sap us. Use maybe a different description, saying, well, maybe it's a belief system that I have. It's something that is sabotaging me. That's what a shadow can do. So he said, when you use this as in meditation or dream work, it can help you to release the shadows that you don't want to have. And of course, Nisha, she says it assists someone in grounding your ideas, your power, and the determination that you want to have in your life. But she says it brings the etheric into the physical. An exquisite stone. So I wanted to share that with you since I'd had a caller that had asked me about that. And also, what I wanted to share with you is a story that I have here. But before I go to that, I've got this recipe. Let me dig it out here. And it is just so simple and yummy. I don't know about you, but sometimes I get so busy that the last thing I want to do is even consider cooking something. But when you can have something that's really, really easy to do, it's magical. And orecchiette, which is a pasta. You can have it with broccoli rabe, which is very, very delicious, and Italian sausage. How does that sound to you? How about sweet Italian sausage? Normally, I like spicy things. I really like spicy food. Well, this is really, really good. Simple, and yet it is just going to be great. It's getting warmer now. We want sort of lighter meals, and this is just delightful. It would be great with just freshly baked bread and a little bit of vino, and you've got a full meal with this. So let me give you the recipe. It's 2 pounds of broccoli rabe, 2 pounds of broccoli, Robbie. You need 1/3 cup of extra virgin olive oil, 1/3 cup. You need 3 cloves of garlic, and you want to slice this garlic. You want 1 teaspoon of kosher salt, 3 Italian sausages, sweet Italian sausages. It's going to be about 1/2 pound of meat. And then you're going to need 8 ounces of your orecchiette pasta. You're going to need 1/2 teaspoon of red pepper flakes, just 1/2 teaspoon now, and 3 tablespoons of fresh lemon juice. And then take another lemon and slice it really, really thinly. This is how easy this recipe is. You're going to preheat your oven to 400 degrees. You cut your stems off of your broccoli, Robbie, along with any discolored leaves, just a normal thing that you would do in preparing it. You want to bring 4 cups of water to a boil. Put your broccoli, Robbie, in it, cover it, and boil it until tender. Now, this may take anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes, depending on how well cooked you like it. You want to drain it in a colander and rinse it in cool water. Another thing you can do is have a bowl filled with water that have ice cubes in it. As soon as you take out the broccoli, Robbie, dump it right in the cold water. And what happens there is that it immediately keeps the color. It's just going to be wonderful with a salad. And then it sort of gives it that cold blanch. And then, of course, it cools it down very, very quickly. And you want to be sure that you take it and put it in a strainer afterwards. And you may need to use a spoon to press the excess moisture out of the broccoli, Robbie. But anyway, you want to, that is being done, that is draining, and that's just a few minutes of time. You want to have a heavy skillet. You want to put it on high heat. On the high heat, you want to then add your oil and your garlic. So you want to have this stuff ready to go because it's going to move along pretty quickly. Add your oil and garlic. Sauté until the garlic starts to turn golden, when it has a fragrance to it. You don't want to burn your garlic. Immediately, you're going to add your broccoli, Robbie, because that's drained. Mix it well. Add your salt. Mix it again. Remove from the heat. Put it aside. Your sausages, you can place on a jelly roll pan, and I should have mentioned this earlier. You want to bake your sausages for 30 to 40 minutes, turning at least 3 times to make sure that they're cooked all the way through. Also, what you can do, if you so desire, is take the sausage out of the casing and cook it in a pan, if you so desire, but it's your choice. But you can make sure, if you want to bake it, then you can do that. That'll take 30 or 40 minutes. Now, once you bake the sausages in the oven, if that's the method you choose to use, then you let them rest for about 10 minutes before you cut them into chunks. And again, you can take it out of the casing and cook it more quickly in the skillet. It won't have to take 30 to 40 minutes. It's up to you. And then you can have smaller pieces of it or big chunks, however you choose to cook it. Now, your pasta, you cook it according to package directions. You drain, return it to the pot that you had cooked it in over medium-high heat. You put in your broccoli, Robbie, your sausage, your pepper flakes. Mix it for a minute. Add a little bit of salt and pepper to taste. Mix in your lemon juice, and you've got your meal. Oh, it is so good, so delicious, and light. It's not something that's going to bog you down. And as I said, a loaf of fresh bread and some good wine, and this is a situation where you could have a light dessert, whatever is your pleasure, but it's a lovely meal for a Sunday dinner or a summer evening dinner. It's just perfect. And if you're a vegetarian, put something else in. If you don't want to have the meat, and you remember, you also with this recipe could adapt it with chicken or pork or beef if that's what you prefer. But those sweet Italian sausages, good flavor, sweet stuff. Well, I don't have time to share the story with you about a young lady who said losing her job was the best thing that ever happened to her. We'll find out about that tomorrow. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Your mind belongs to you. Your heart, your spirit is your own. Take dominion and understand that your light, keep it turned on, because you are very significant and important. Thank you for sharing this time with me today, this Memorial Day. And my hat is off to all the veterans who have been honored through this day's activities. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be with me. We'll be here same time, same place tomorrow, right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.